The Dr. Peter Bragan Hour, Mondays at 5 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry and Medication Madness? It's the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour with guests and callers seeking the truth about psychiatry and psychotherapy and how you can make the most of your own life right here on the Progressive Radio Network.
And this is Dr. Peter Bragan. And before I get to my very interesting guest today, I've got to perform one more of my functions as the conscience of psychiatry. We have another one of those catastrophes being generated by my colleagues in psychiatry and medicine, in this case, in pediatrics. The American Academy of Pediatrics, about 1 week ago, in all of its wisdom, overrode even the FDA and decided we can diagnose 4-year-old children with ADHD and give them specifically Ritalin-like drugs, methylphenidate drugs. Now, we already have a massive overdrugging and overdiagnosing of our children. It's already a catastrophe, and this will open the doors to physicians and prescribers of every ilk to doing even more drugging of our children. And it won't just be methylphenidate. What's really happening here is that the door's being opened wide just by permitting the diagnosis of ADHD and the use of Ritalin. Because when the Ritalin doesn't work, or when the doc thinks Ritalin is not the best drug, there's always those wonderful amphetamines, Adderall and Dexedrine and so on. And once you've given the children one of these drugs and they get overstimulated, there's always giving them a sedative to quiet them down because we won't stop the original drug. And when we've got them on sedatives and we've got them on stimulants and they start getting depressed, there's always antidepressants. And when that makes them crazy, we add an antipsychotic. We already have scandals of 2-year-olds being put on these drugs. Now docs are going to feel empowered to do it with 4-year-olds. Go to my website. I told you last week we have a new website in addition to Bragan.com, my personal site, in addition to empathictherapy.org. We now have toxicpsychiatry.com, toxicpsychiatry.com, to keep you up on the negative aspects, and empathic therapy to keep you up on the positive aspects. And on toxicpsychiatry.com, a new, wonderful, bright website dealing with what's going on with my colleagues around the world, you'll find an article about the American Academy of Pediatrics and its decision and its implications. Now, my guest today is someone whom I don't personally know, often I do, and I'm really looking forward to this. His name is Dr. Nathaniel J. Williams. He has an interesting life story, which I hope he will tell you, but briefly, very briefly, at the age of 5, his mom died, and 9 of his 11 siblings ended up in the New York City system for foster children. So he's 5 years old in the foster system, and he stays there for a while. Now, given the American Academy of Pediatrics, he's going to have, at that age, an even increased likelihood of getting diagnosed and drugged. But this man has gone on to build a life for himself precisely on the principles of overcoming the kind of incredible adversity that he met. His latest book, it's a workbook, a guidebook, is Attaining Your Personal Best, a theme dear to me and which I think is by far a better goal when you're helping people than, quote, treating their bipolar disorder or their clinical depression, because it really always comes down on one level to another to attaining your personal best. And that's our goal, whether we're trainers or inspirational speakers or therapists. Dr. Williams, welcome to the show.
Well, Dr. Peter, thank you so much for having me. It's an honor to be here.
Well, give us more of your background. I really love it when a guest can talk about where they've come from and where they're going and apply their principles of living to their own life and the lives of others. So, you know, begin somewhere in there where you're comfortable.
Sure. Thanks so much. As you said, I was in foster care at the age of five and stayed there for 13 years and aged out of the system. And had 9 other brothers and sisters who had the same situation. And 2 of my siblings were old enough and already out on their own when my mother passed away. She went to the hospital saying her head was hurting, and they gave her some pills and sent her on her way. And she took about 10 steps outside the hospital and fell dead. And again, having 12 children, 10 that were under 18 that needed to be cared for. The New York City system called and asked us, her brothers and sisters and other family members, would they consider taking the children, but I think the number of 10 kids was way too high to ask any one person or one couple to take. So they ended up dividing us up and sending us off to 5 different placements, basically 2 kids in each placement. So again, I spent 13 years in foster care, And had an opportunity when I was about 15 or 16 to volunteer and work with some adults with developmental disabilities, and really enjoyed that. And so, when I aged out of the system, began higher education, but really had a great affinity for people with developmental disabilities and started working with them, and then eventually, returned back to the foster care system. Which I came from, and began working with children as well. And then in my mid-20s, I founded an agency in Pennsylvania that brought both of those worlds together, of kids in foster care as well as adults with developmental disabilities, and have been doing the job of being as president and chief executive officer for the last 20 years or so. That's where I am today, and running a nonprofit with about 250 employees and a budget of about $12 million, serving about 200 people between the adults with mental retardation and autism and other developmental disabilities, and then the dependent children who are placed with us in our foster care program.
This is state funded, Dr. Williams?
Yes, and a lot of the state funds is matched by federal funds, but primarily it's administered by the state, and the feds are basically giving them a dollar for every dollar that they put up in order to offer the services that we offer.
It must be incredibly satisfying to come back and help kids like yourself.
It really is, Peter. And what's interesting is when I began working with adults with developmental disabilities, I had no idea that my wife and I would eventually have a child with autism. So we have a 5-year-old child who is a twin. The male twin has autism. The female does not. And I never knew that, when I started this kind of work, that it would actually hit home in a way. But it is, one of the things a friend said to me, if any child had to have autism, it would be best that your wife and yourself are the persons to deal with it. Because of your knowledge and your compassion. So, that has been somewhat of a challenge. We have 8 children altogether, and 5 of them are 6 and under, and he's one of those 5. So we have our plate full at home as well as at work.
Now, those are all your own biological kids, not foster kids?
Correct. There's one that is 7 are our biological children. One is an adopted a teenager, a girl from my mother-in-law's home country of Liberia, but the 7 children are our own biological.
Now, do you you manage to apply these principles that you write about attaining your personal best, also the title of your book. Do you manage to apply them in the clinic itself? And if so, how do you go about that major task?
Sure. We don't have clinics per se. We have, you know, residential programs where we're providing these supports and services to individuals. So that's where we apply these principles. And really the concept of attaining your personal best is really to talk about 11 things that, you know, get in the way of us attaining our personal best. You know, one is, you know, accepting reality and embracing things as they are rather than how we want them to be. Another one is understanding the role of fear. Another one is recognizing that becoming different is a tough task. So there's 11 conversations that the book attempted to put out on the table as to some of the reasons why we struggle with attaining our personal best. And as you said, Peter, you know, Peter's personal best versus Nat's versus Mary versus Tom's is totally different. And we want to encourage people to do what feels good to you and what makes you happy and what defines your destiny as opposed to someone else's. But again, I think there's some universal conversations that we need to have in order to make that happen. And that's what the concepts and the principles are, is that there are some courageous conversations that we need to have with ourselves and others so that we can be transparent and really embrace the things that were meant for our life.
Tell us some more about transparent. That's a concept in
your
book.
One of the things I believe, and that's the first chapter in the book, Peter, is that I believe you're one or the other. Either you're transparent or you're running a conspiracy. And so I'm having this conversation with you today, Peter, and either I'm going to be transparent with you or I'm going to be trying to run a conspiracy. And another word we use for there is to run a scam. And every moment of the day, we have to make that decision whether or not we're going to be one or the other. And I think a lot of our challenges to attaining our personal best, a lot of our frustrations and trauma, it comes from living a life of conspiracy and being less than truthful with ourselves and with others. So that's one of the things that is, you know, paramount to me, is that I want to be transparent. And I tell people, you know, if I know it, you know it. I believe there's a television, there's a telephone, there's your radio show, and then there's Telnat Williams. And equally, all of those are equal to getting the word out there. My job is not to be a barrier to people. So that's part of being transparent, is because I think, again, a lot of energy goes into living behind that camouflage. And it's like having that neighbor next door. It takes so much energy to ignore them. It just takes a second to wave and say hello. But we spend a lot of time attempting to be in a conspiracy with them or against them rather than being transparent with them, and it makes life a lot easier. So just recognizing that, again, a lot of challenges come our way because we're just not being genuine and authentic to ourselves and others.
Well, you know, I've spent a lifetime trying to be genuine about my profession of psychiatry and what I think is right and what I think is wrong in the services we provide. And it does take courage.
Yes.
Because you take a lot of lumps and you have to challenge yourself and deal with things. Looking back on your life now, the tragedy in your life is at age 5, or the beginning of the tragedy. You're a strong person. You probably had some good nurturing before your mom left, I'm guessing. Is that accurate?
Yes, I mean, I don't remember very much about her, but, you know, from all the things that I do hear from others, she was a very strong and committed, and there are days in which she woke up and just put a pot on the stove, and somehow or another, every night, there was something in it. So that, you know, there's no question that she was a good provider and did the very best she could with what she had.
Did you, along the way, after age 5, have some kind of a relationship with an adult or an older sibling or someone who helped you develop your strength, or did you just pull yourself up based on those first 5 years?
Well, one of the things I think is important to recognize is that we hear the phrase that it takes a village to raise a child, and I add on to that, but it takes the world to raise a foster child. That reality is there are so many different people that played a part in my life. And so often what happens as a foster child is you want one person to show up and to fill in that position that is left vacant. And one of the things that I try to share with other foster children is that because of the complexities of the issues that you're dealing with, it may be too much for just one person. So allow different people to come in, and there'll be someone that helps you, you know, play football better, another person that may help you to read, another person that may take you, you know, teach how to play an instrument. But again, so often in our society, we're used to that family structure, and when it comes to foster children, a lot of times that family structure has been decimated. And so I you know, share with people that for 35 years I stood at the foot of my mother's casket attempting to wake her up, and I didn't realize I was doing that. And so often when we lose people, and as foster children sometimes do, they're holding a seat for someone that will never come back. And if anyone tries to sit on the edge of that seat to try to mentor us and support us, we kick them off of that because we believe that that seat is going to be reoccupied by that person. So one of the things I try to share with people that it's important to understand that instead of trying to be a survivor of the death of your mother or a survivor of any challenge in your life, that you really want to be a conqueror and you want to be a person that really, you know, gets beyond just being able to cope with it. And you really say to yourself, I can put this, you know, behind me and put it into perspective. I will never be the same having had this experience, but I don't have to be worse off because I've had that experience. And so that's the kind of mindset that followed me. And, you know, one day I was in an orphanage, and I was about 11 or 12 years old, and my brothers and sisters were supposed to come to visit, and they couldn't. And the van broke down, and I was sitting in front of the administration building waiting, for some sympathy. And down comes Sister Mary Patrick, and she sees me sitting there and says, Nat, what's wrong? And I explained to her about the visit. And she goes downstairs to, tells me to sit there, and goes downstairs to the storeroom and comes up with a bicycle and gives it to me. And I was a happy camper because I felt, you know, so gifted. And I rode off to my cottage, and my other cottage mates were riding the bicycle. And I was watching one of them as they were riding away, and it just hit me, you know, very strongly. And again, I was 11, you know, 12 maybe at that time, and it hit me that if I wasn't careful, that was going to be the story of my life, you know, telling a sad story and waiting for a handout. And I recognized that Sister Mary Patrick was very powerful, that within seconds she was able to, you know, to gift me and to try to change my profession. So I started signing my name, Peter, Nathaniel J. Williams, Executive Director. It took me another 12 years for that to become my official title and earning that title. But I believe firmly that's what we have to do when we have a challenge in our life, is to develop a plan. And if we don't have a plan, we'll always be working for someone that does. And a lot of times that plan may not be in our best interest. And so we need to, you know, to develop that plan and then work that plan. And so that, I think, so often when you're dealing with the kind of devastations that we all have a tendency to come our way, We just have to decide, am I going to be a survivor or am I going to be a conqueror? Am I going to be a person that really, you know, takes this and lets it be a part of who I am, but it doesn't define who I am? And so often for people and the events that happen in their life, they become defined by the challenge, and I refuse to allow that to happen to me. Where it came from, I don't know, but I see that same quality in lots of my brothers and sisters. And this weekend, this Friday, I go off to speak to a group of wardens in New York State at their annual conference, and they've asked me to serve as their keynote speaker. Little do they realize, they house my brother, who was there for committing murder for the rest of their life. And so reality is sometimes that's the stark difference. By reframing the things in your life, either you're the inspirational speaker for the wardens, or you're one of the inmates that the warden is taking care of. And so that's just a reminder to me that we have choices, and we have to be very careful with the choices that we make. And especially if we're leading our life how we've been hurt, lots of times that's going to cause, you know, great trauma for us. I try to lead my life how I've been inspired and how I've been loved. And that's hard, especially with some of the things I've dealt with. But I recognize that's where I do my best work. I don't do my best work when I'm leading my life how I've been hurt and letting that be my guide. I try to let my sense of optimism and hope make a big difference. And especially as you go on, to try to break that cycle. I didn't have a father. I don't know who my father is. There's no name on my birth certificate. But I hope and I pray that that hasn't stopped me from breaking the cycle. That, and what I think the highest compliment a person has ever said to me is, Nat, if you are a person without a father, I would never know it. And I think that's what we have to do with our life, is as best we can with the things that have happened, to not let it define ourselves and allow for us to occupy those roles and learn as much as we can about the much we don't know about it, but still don't vacate that role because it was vacated for us. We have to understand, we have to stop passing that torch on to the next generation.
Dr. Nathaniel Williams, I am so glad to have you on the show. I'm usually a conversationalist who interrupts, but what you're saying is so powerful, so clear, so universal, that I'm happy to sit back. I was stunned by your initial metaphor of, you know, standing at the casket at 5 years old for the rest of your life, hoping that person's going to come back. I think that that is a metaphor for not just, of course, foster children, but all people lost in an abusive, negligent, lonely childhood. We often stand at the casket and bang on the casket and scream and into the casket, wanting to get back what in your case was lost, or in some cases was never even there. And you're giving such a vivid description of whether or not it's that you lost it, as in your case with your mother, or it never was there, as in the case of your father, how it's up to the individual to grow and to use and find other people. And I think what you're saying about finding a number of people who can satisfy various aspects and give to you, and to whom you can give back to. You haven't talked much about that yet, but I'm sure you have a lot to say also about the importance of giving back. Before I forget, is there a website or a way that you would like people to be able to get in touch with you?
Sure. There's a website that a group has put together that I think is, they did a wonderful job. It's www.drnatwilliams.com, so drnatwilliams.com. And it really gives a wonderful platform to the books, to us. We had a TV show that we had last year, and some speaking engagements. It really gives a good platform to the different things that I've been working on. So, you know, people should feel free to use that. And then they can, of course, contact me by email or telephone or whichever way, or by writing. So that's a good website for people to use.
That's great. That's really, really good. Did you, along the way as a child, it's a while ago, but did you run afoul of psychiatry, as so many young children are doing? Well, now, of course, just about every child in foster care is drugged. That's my experience. Is it the same as yours?
It's the same thing. And one of the things that we try so hard is to look at what they're on, and is there a way for us to find a way to not be on it? Because one of the things I share with my colleagues is that every medication has the same side effect, and it'll say to you, may cause death. And so I really want people to be very cognizant that if they're allowing a child to have that go into their body, that it's something that they really feel very strongly and convinced that it's, there is the only way. And lots of times when that ultimatum is given to them, they tend to find other mechanisms. When I was in placement, the agency was changing the programs around because funding changed. And one day the staff left a piece of paper on the table, and it said on the piece of paper, Nathaniel Williams, latent schizophrenic. And I didn't know what that meant. I've come to figure out what it means now. But in order to get me into the funding that needed to be done, there went that category and that label. So it didn't tell the staff what to do. It just gave me a code that could be built upon. And so often that's what our systems are built upon. It's really about problems. It's not about solutions. And that's what we really need to look at, is if the label helps us to get solutions, wonderful. But if the label just helps us to understand that the problems a person has, there's a real challenge with that. And we have a system that just loves, whether it's the mental health system, whether it's the foster care system, whether it's the system for supporting adults or people with disabilities, it's very much a voyeur kind of system where they just want to watch what's going on and do nothing to stop it. And we have to say enough is enough. And, you know, one of my colleagues has a wonderful phrase that if you want something different, you got to do something different. And so often we're just doing the same thing over and over again with all these wonderful aspirations that we've come to find out really don't materialize into anything in the long run. And one of the books that I wrote was about the affordability factor, which is basically a financial term, but I tried to use it as a personal development term. It's to really look at the person who I am. Based on who I am, what am I able to afford? And the people, the places, and the things, what am I able to afford in my health, in my spirituality, in my family and friends, in my recreation? And so often, because of all the things that we've experienced, we can afford very little. And thus, we get very little. And so I think one of the major things is to look at how affordable are we for our dreams? How affordable are we for others? Who can really afford to be our friends? Who can really afford to be our employers? And lots of times, because we're so challenged and so jacked up in our personality based on all the things that have happened, we only were able to attract more problems and more challenges to our life. And so one of the things that I believe very much is in fellowship, where I think the most powerful, you know, three words in the English language is cut it out. And I need to be in fellowship with other people that can tell me that and then support me along that journey. And the single most powerful word in the English language to me is the word and. We live in a society that keeps telling us it's or. You take either, you know, a Xanax or something else. And reality is we need to recognize that our wholeness is going to come from is the and. I come to you, Peter, as a father and a husband and as a brother and as an employer and as a motivational speaker. And that just reminds me of the fullness of who I am. But if I live in this world that just keeps telling me every time I'm talking to someone, I have to be one or the other and don't allow for my full self, the whole person of who I am to come forth, that fragmentation allows for a lot of the things to come pouring out of my life that is not supposed to. So I've learned it's and that's what I have to remind myself, that I kind of keep building and making sure that I'm not isolating myself. And again, that's recognizing, as I said back to the children, they need a mom, they need and a dad. But a lot of times we're in a society now that says you have a mom or a dad, and we wonder why the challenges are coming in. So to me, it's important to recognize that it's the end. And so you may have medications that you're taking, but the therapy is really important, and exercise is really important, and the spirituality is really important. But a lot of times we do one thing and we wonder why everything is not coming together. It's the word and that we're missing a lot of times in our vocabulary.
One of the things I wonder about is if, in fact, many children are going to be able to rise to the challenge the way you have when every one of them in foster care now is pretty much diagnosed and medicated. We're going to go to break in about 30 seconds. And I'd like you to be thinking, if you're willing, you may not want to deal with this issue on the air, and that's okay. But
no,
I would love
fine.
To hear your thoughts on this problem that pretty much all the kids in foster care now are going to be on medication. They're going to be diagnosed. They're going to be told that they have a disorder that they can't control. They're going to be given exactly the opposite message that you're giving. And to whatever extent you want to deal with that issue, I'd love to have you deal with it when we come back after break.
Sure.
Thank you.
You are listening to the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour on the Progressive Radio Network. Stay tuned, stay in touch, and call in with your questions at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888.
This is Dr. Peter Bragan, and my guest, my wonderful guest, is Nathaniel Williams, Dr. Nathaniel Williams, who has been providing us some universal insights into what it means to come from a background of loss, of hurt, of injury, and to find your strength and to attain your personal best. Doc, are you there?
I'm here, Peter. Doc Peter.
Take off, Nathaniel, wherever you would like. I'm happy to listen to you for a little bit.
Sure. Peter, you were asking just before the break about this issue of children and the diagnosis and, you know, and the medication of so many children in our society, but definitely a lot of children in foster care. And one of the things that I think is so prevalent in the helping profession, especially for children that are very challenged, why these diagnoses come and the medications follow, is I do think it's an attempt to try to be helpful, because a lot of times they're looking at this diagnosis as a map, and that they can do something about the issue. But so often we're missing the importance of the person, that's the helper, to recognize that sometimes it's just being present and available. When you talk to these kids, that's what they're really suffering from, that people are in their life, they're present, but they're just not available to them. And it's like that father who's sitting there watching the football game. He's present, but he's not available. And in these children's lives and in so many children's lives, we have people that are present and unavailable, and then sometimes we have it where they're just not present and they're just not available at all. But I think the greatest pain that children are experiencing now is people that are present and unavailable to them because of their job, because of the other responsibilities, because of a new family. You know, when I was in foster care, you know, I was one of a few kids that was an orphan. But as time has gone on, we have a lot of kids that are in placement and that are out of their home, and they have mom and dad, and mom and dad have chosen something else other than them. And I thought I was in pain, but I recognize the pain of so many children today is far greater than mine ever was, because I understood where everybody was and why they weren't there. I could eventually understand that. But, you know, we had a situation, we have programs in Philadelphia, and one of the kids had said, hey, I want to go down to this local park. And staff said, okay, fine, we'll take you there. And then they got about halfway there, and the kid said, never mind. And the staff was like, why? It's because my mom lives there. And I really don't want to see her like that. The staff originally, when they left out, thought they were just going to meet up with the parent who was going to be at the park for a function, not to come to find out that that's where the parent is living. So reality is, so often those are the kinds of things that we're dealing with, is people that are present and unavailable to the children, and I think their pain is so great. So often we try to figure out a way to map to deal with that, but sometimes it's just as simple as we have to find a way for people to show up in these kids' life and stay there, and especially when the times get tough. Peter, we had a kid the other day that he's 12 years old. I think this week he turns 13, and he's been a handful. And we said, well, you know, I want you to explain to us what you're doing with your behavior. And Peter, he gave the most profound answer. He said, I push the buttons of the adults to see if I can get them to behave like me. And if I can see that they behave like me, I don't want anything to do with them. And there's only one person in my life right now who I can't get to behave just like me. And that's the only time you'll ever see where I'm not in trouble, is when that person is around me. This kid is 12 years old. So reality is, so often the answer is there, and if you're able to have courageous conversations and to talk with them, they can almost self-medicate. They know what they need to do, and it sometimes is they just need the love and the attention and the time. And I've learned to do the right thing, Peter, takes more time, money, and other resources. To be a good husband, to be a good father, to be a good, you know, for you to be a good psychiatrist, to be a good motivational speaker, whatever the role is in our life, you can't do it on the cheap. And so often with these diagnoses and medications, people are attempting to do it on the cheap. I give you a few minutes, I tell you what your problem is, give you some pills, and everything is going to be better. But we really, it's about making an investment, and we live in a society that wants a quick return on our investment, and with the kind of issues we're dealing with, Peter, it's going to take a lot of us staying power to deal with this. And so often these children are just looking at us to see if we're strong enough, and they're looking to make sure that our language is not fear-based and it's power-based, and they're looking to see that we're conquerors of their issues, not just trying to survive it, just not trying to cope with it, that we really want to make it disappear from the radar screen as time would allow for it. Because again, some of the things that they're dealing with, it's going to take some time for it to dissipate. But they want to see that people are committed, and that's the test. And a lot of us, especially adults, and school systems and mental health programs, are failing that test. And these children are reaching a very early demise, and it's something it's a wake-up call to all of us that we have to start doing things differently.
One of the things I really like about the way you talk about the children is that these are universal principles, and we could say the same thing about husbands and wives relating to each other, that often we're there, but we're not present. We're in the room, but we're not present. Or we're in the life, but we're not present. Or we're not patient. Or we're not willing to do the work and put in the time. And we live in a culture now that is just having a terrible time in any area seeing that you got to do the work. And you got to make yourself of value. And you've got to be someone that other people will benefit from. Was there a time when you began to realize that it wasn't just I'm sure there was. I'm just wondering what you have to say about it. What was the time when you began to realize it wasn't enough to have executive director or whatever that was after your name when you were a kid, but you'd have to actually think about what your contribution was going to be?
Sure. I recognize that I was given some strong DNA, but that was not enough in order to leave a legacy. And what I was trying to overcome and the devastation of my family, it's going to take a lot of extra help. And what I wanted to accomplish, it's going to take a lot. And so that was a wake up call for me. And I guess in my later 20s was that. You know, I've been blessed, and I founded an agency, and it was beginning to grow, but I shouldn't stop at that particular point either. That, you know, it goes back to that point earlier I said about and. And so sometimes when people look at my initials behind my name, they see a master's in human services and a master's in public administration and a master's in business administration and a doctorate in education. And they're like, where is that coming from? Well, if you understand my story and you understand my history, it's what I have to do in order to come to the table, because some people were blessed with some of those things. They had a politician in their life. You know, they had an educator in their life. You know, they had a social worker in there. Reality is I was missing a lot of those things, and so I had to go back and get them at a later point. So it's important for me to recognize that I want my life to matter. I want to have an impact. And one of the things I got to do is I have to learn about the many things I don't know about, and I have to be open to that and receptive to that. And that was part of my pursuit of higher education. Some people do that, Peter, with sports. Some people do that with their spirituality. Some do that. So I just chose to use education as a way to try to augment where I was missing some of that that mentoring that a parent would give, that I was able to grab it later. But we have to recognize that we have to get it at some particular point, and we have to be open to that. And I think so often for a lot of people, they're so closed to making themselves better. And I believe in that, you know, life is a journey. It's not a destination. I will never get to be my personal best until it's my final day, because that will be the best I could have done up to that particular point. But it's a journey. It's not a destination. And so reality is, I don't know what tomorrow holds, but I recognize I could have never envisioned, Peter, that I'd be sitting, you know, here talking to you. But what I had to do was just to say, I'm going to do my very best. I'm going to be in fellowship with others who can afford to see me do my very best. And, you know, one of the things that people have found out is you generally don't do better than your five closest friends. So check out who your five closest friends are, because so often when you go back to them and you tell them, hey, I was on a radio show talking to, you know, talk Dr. Peter today. Hopefully they can sit there and say, wonderful, I hope that you're now going to have a chance to talk back with him again, or, well, I went on the internet and I found this wrong with Dr. Peter, or whatever it is, that they should be able to celebrate with your, but we live in a lot of relationships that are really unaffordable for the dreams and aspirations that we're looking for. So I think it's so important is for us to decide where we want to go, How can we get there? And recognize there's also a part of us that if we can dream it, it's really probably not the fullness of our destiny, because so many doors are going to open up as you begin to walk that path. I believe when we look at people, you're looking about a 10% of the capacity of who they could be, because of those challenging life events have stole so much enthusiasm. They stole so much desire to dream from them. You're only seeing a fragment, and people say that person is a billionaire. But I want you to understand that you're still looking at a person operating at probably 10, maybe 20% of the person that they really can be. But if you listen to their challenging life event and then listen to what they've done, you can see how their hurt has governed even their limited success, but we didn't know any better. And so often, why is that important to pay attention to? Because if they're at the pinnacle and they're only 10%, we're looking to them as the guidepost. What percentage do you think we're at, if that's the best that we're believing that a person can be? So it's so important that we're in fellowship with other people that can tell us, as I said earlier, to cut it out and to walk with our vision of the future and walk toward that and celebrate those little steps along the way. We live in a society that wants to hold everything back until this big, you know, Christmas day or birthday, and I've learned to celebrate every single opportunity. So when I get off the phone with you, Peter, I'm going to celebrate that I had a chance to meet someone new. And I'm not waiting for it to be that, you know, we see each other in person, and reality is those little things that happen every day, because it gives me the optimism to go forth. And I think a lot of times those are the things that we're missing, is to recognize everything takes time. And I went across overseas for the first time this spring to speak to the troops for 19 days and 6 different countries. And I was working with a person, and he gave me a phrase to use by Winston Churchill. And the phrase was, never, 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 never give up. And I use that phrase because so often we are people that give up after the first never, the second never, and we don't hold in there long enough. And things do take time. Most of us are not going to be overnight sensations. It's going to be staying in there for the duration of the time, and remembering a lot of times our success is going to be after that third and fourth, if not fifth, never, that we stuck in there long enough and didn't give up, even though society says, you know, your shift is up and you don't have to do anymore. We just have to stay in there just a little bit longer.
Nathaniel Williams, it's just a pleasure to listen to what you're saying. Do you feel that therapy, counseling, has a place in this kind of attaining your personal best? Oh. Did you have any counseling that was helpful to you?
Yes, and I believe that there's formal counseling, Peter, by people that are credentialed, and then there's informal counseling. It goes back to that point, Peter, about and. We need so much to, you know, and so much transparency to reach our personal best, that wherever you can get some help by a person that can truly afford to see you do well, whether it's paid and unpaid, natural or unnatural, you need to get that support. So I think it's so important, but to check out. And you know, one of the things we don't do is we don't study success. We don't go back and say, well, before I sign up with Peter, I need to talk about who has he helped before and what have they done with their life. And I don't want you to breach confidentiality, but I do want to talk about what you've been able to do for other people. And so often we attach people. I say very clearly, I can't do for you something I haven't done for myself. And that if you do it, it is not because of me. It's in spite of me sometimes. And we need to know the difference between the two, because there's a distinct difference if someone's able to be successful because of you or in spite of you. So I think we need to, if we're going to find those formal supports, we really need to check it out, and it really needs to be something that's validated, that we're getting help from someone that has some success behind them. And if the success is not there, then we understand that we're going to compensate for that gamble by making sure that there are other people in our lives that can shore us up while we may be working with someone who's building up their success rate. But I think it's so important to recognize it's that and, Peter. It's there's so many, you know, we have so many issues we're dealing with. To put all your eggs in one basket and do wishful thinking and having a Dorothy moment where you're clicking your heels 3 times and hoping you wake up in Kansas, I think is a mistake. We have to spread out and diversify and really make sure that we have so many tentacles in so many different places to brace, you know. So a friend said to me, like, Nat, why do you have so many different companies? Why do you do training and you have recreation company? It's because reality is, to brace a person that has been traumatized as much as I have, it's going to take a lot to interest me, to excite me. And so reality, I think it's so important, is to make sure that you're doing the stuff that you enjoy. And reality is, a lot of us enjoy lots of things. Why don't we do the stuff that we enjoy and find a way for that to compensate our life, and so that we can be comfortable? A lot of us are doing things that we really don't enjoy, and we're believing that we can't do the things that we enjoy. And I try to show with people that that is a lie, and don't believe that. It's going to take some time and crafting to make it happen, but we shouldn't prostitute ourselves for the almighty dollar, because so often that's where the therapy and the medications and other things are coming in, is because you really are not a happy person. You're not doing the kinds of things that make you happy. So, you know, it's important that you're around other people that can help you to strategize about how you're going to get there and make those things happen. And so often you've gone as far as you can by yourself. And so that's where the fellowship comes in, where others can help you to and augment you to take you to that next level. But again, there's very few things in life that you do by yourself. And one is birth and the other one is death. And everything in between is supposed to be in fellowship. And that's the way I try to lead my life, is recognizing that isolation lots of times is what causes me the biggest problem. If I can get with one other person or two other people, it makes the world a difference for making things happen.
My wife was looking through your book, Attaining Your Personal Best, and she came to the dedication, and she said to me, Peter, you could have written that about me. And the phrase that caught her eye was, when you're talking about her in your dedication, and her name is Tade. Am I pronouncing it right, T-A-D-E?
It's Tade.
Tade. Tade.
Yes.
You say, she has taught me what true love looks like. It is the most beautiful sight. It is her. Oh, please talk about that.
Sure. You know, one of the things that's so important is to find other people in your life that can help you see the beauty when you can't see it. And that's what she has done, is that she's helped me to recognize that love is what we all are questing. And if I was angry about anything about the death of my mother, was that she couldn't love me any longer in the way I felt that was necessary. And so often, because that happens, we shut it off all the other places. And what my wife has done for me is allowed for that to be open, and she can tell me to cut it out. And what it's interesting, Peter, is, you know, her father walked away from her when she was 2 years old. My mother died, you know, when I was 5. And then the two of us want to come together and make a happy home. Well, if we're not going to be transparent, if we're not going to learn to laugh about some of the pain that we've experienced, if we're not going to understand that we are our own worst enemy, left alone, it's going to be a miserable existence. And that's why we would only, if we weren't trying hard, only get 10 years out of the relationship, and 5 of those years were miserable. That we were able to turn that around by saying that I recognize I need someone else, and they're not going to always be perfect, and I'm not going to be perfect, but we agree to take this journey and make it the most, understanding that based on what we both experienced, this was not meant to be, and we want to look that situation in the face and say, you didn't get this couple. And that we're going to go ahead and do the things that we need to do. And one of the things with, you know, families with couples with autistic children, the level of divorce is so very high. Because again, everyone wants things to be perfect. And when you have that child that may not be seen by society to be perfect. We went on a cruise a couple of weekends ago that was a cruise out of New York to nowhere. And, you know, Taj sometimes makes loud noises and does other things. And earlier on, we were embarrassed. And now we just learned to say that's what he does when he's happy. And if you don't like it, there's a big boat. Go find someplace else to sit. And again, it's that love of ourselves individually, and then as a couple and as a family, that I'm not looking for the approval of everybody else. I'm looking for the approval of someone that has shown through time that they love me and I love them. And again, that to me has been the best and the most important blessing in my life, was finding someone who could afford to love me and I could afford to love. And I think we have so much, it's not material, it's more on the emotional side that keeps us all going when the challenges happen. And to me, that was so important. And I based on what I've experienced, Peter, I thought I would never get that. But sometimes we have to recognize if we lead our life based on what we don't want, guess what? That's what we get. And what I've learned is I needed to lead my life declaring what I wanted and stop talking about what I don't want, because, again, that's a map to get to what I don't want. I laid out what I was looking for, and surprisingly, because I was leading with that as my vision, I was able to find it. But I recognize that so many people talk in the negative, talk in the fear, rather than declaring with a positive and sticking to it. You know, so often you see a person and they have a nice sweater and you say, that is the most beautiful sweater. Instantaneously, they'll sit there and say, oh, this costs $5 and I got it from a thrift store. We just cheapen the moment, and we just have to just allow things to be good and to say positive things and leave it there and don't subtract from it. But there's almost a natural innate interest in us of wanting to take away from the positive. And I just learned to allow myself to bathe, to say, you know what? This was a really good time to spend with Peter. You know, reality is I'm not going to say, oh, there wasn't enough time or this, or I forgot to cover this. Leave that alone. Just to bathe myself in the moment, to meet someone new, and to have a chance to dialogue, and he listened to me and I listened to him. Just bathe yourself in that and move on to the next positive experience. But so often what we end up doing is subtracting from something that really should have been left to be the positive that it was.
Do you have a higher spiritual concept that you'd want to share with us? Or is
sure.
that not a part of your life?
No, I believe that spirituality is so very important. And I think to recognize when you just look at our lives, it's so complicated that there has to be something bigger than us that is influencing what it is. And you talk to people that are, you know, that American Indian, and they believe that, you know, that it comes from the environment, and other people believe that it comes from other places. But the reality is that, to me, is just recognizing this is just too powerful and too complicated to just be us that has our hand on it, and just to recognize that there's something greater and something more powerful than just me, and I have to figure out a way how to navigate that. So I share with people, I don't care if your higher power is a pencil, whatever it is, but just to recognize that there's something that contributed to where you are today, and the question is, what do you want to do in respect to recognizing that you most likely didn't get here on your own whim, and there's some other influences that you need to give respect and homage to.
Well, I'm just really enjoying having you on the show. We've been talking with Dr. Nathaniel J. Williams. Can people just Google Dr. Nathaniel J. Williams and will they find you?
For sure. And it'll come right up and there'll be up some links. So that's another good way, Peter, for people to reach out.
This is the show that I've done the most listening on of all of my shows because I really love what you have to say. And I think that many, many people are going to be inspired by what you have to say. This show, like all of my shows, will be, and all the shows on our network, on the Progressive Radio Network, will be archived and can be downloaded easily. And this is a show that I think you might find useful in giving out, Dr. Williams, and I think people are going to find it real important to listen to.
Sure.
This is Dr. Peter Bregan. This is The Conscience of Psychiatry. It's been a genuine pleasure to have as my guest Dr. Nathaniel J. Williams. He's an inspiration to all of us. And I look forward to having you back on the show at some other time and to staying in touch with you.
Sure, sure.
If you get a chance when the show is over, please feel free to get my contact information from my marvelous engineer, Giselle, or to give him your contact information. And let's talk as soon as we can, just to stay in touch.
Thank you for all you do, Peter.
Thank you. And this is Dr. Peter Bregan saying good night. The Conscience of Psychiatry is done for this show.
You've been listening to the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with a new live show every Monday evening at 5 p.m. East Coast time on the Progressive Radio Network, where each show is archived for your convenience. You can learn more about Dr. Bregan and his lifelong reform work on www.bregan.com. That's B-R-E-G-G-I-N.com.